Know the past, shape the future. Welcome to the official podcast of the Air Force Historical Foundation. On this episode, we're continuing our conversation on the technological origins of the modern United States Air Force. Much of what the modern Air Force is doing now was fostered under the care of General Hap Arnold. Today, we're talking to a man who knows the personal side of General Arnold, his grandson, Robert Arnold. But there's a twist. Mr. Arnold is not only the grandson of Hap Arnold, he's also the grandson of Donald Douglas, which puts him in the unique position of understanding the human side of this fascinating period of history and some of the backstories on how it actually came together. Here now is Mr. Robert Arnold.
Well, and Hap had died just before I was born, sadly. He died at about 64, really early by today's standards. I did know Donald Douglas a little bit, and he was a very interesting person. My father, luckily for me, loved all the stories and the history and the experiences, and really made them come alive. Talked about them a lot. He would spin stories when we would go places, meet people, or even things in the house. He'd pick something out of a drawer and talk about when Hap had given them that and where it came from, things like that. So I grew up with the idea that this was a fascinating story to tell and to know, and also particularly kind of the funny and human sides of things, which the Arnold family certainly has lots of parts of. But the thing that also came across with all these things, and my father made it very clear to me early on, which is what his father had given to him, which is like, you never, ever wear another man's rank. You know, that I am not him. You know, I'm here to tell stories and enjoy the history and the people we met, but you're not going to strut around being somebody important. And that was made clear to him when he was a child, as they were at down at Rockwell Field, and his younger brother, Dave, had taunted somebody in his class saying, you know, my father owns this whole place and your father works for him, and that kind of thing. And his father let him have it. It was made very clear to them. So it's always been clear to me that I'm just a partial witness to history and a reminder of history and know some knowledge and things. And that's what I enjoy a lot. So I became very much a history guy. Not before I went to college, in college, and subsequently, I enjoy the stories about people and like. And when I met people, and I was lucky to meet some of these people along the way, Jimmy Doolittle is an example of that, but many other ones as well. It was the ability to fill in the blanks about these characters and have them tell me stories too. And that's been a real privilege in my life. So that's how I see it.
What have you discovered about Hap Arnold on the family side that maybe we wouldn't know? What was he like?
On the human side, this is a man who is has a great sense of humor. He's a practical joker. He likes doing things like that. He likes having fun and smile and laugh and be with people who are the same way. So this isn't a lone gunslinger type. I mean, this is definitely that kind of person. That's part of it. But Pop would talk about him, also say to always remember that this is a man who was absolutely sure of himself, that he would absolutely be clear about these matters. You know, whatever he decided to believe, he believed. But he wasn't a doctrinaire. In other words, if you could show him that you had actually done something, you had data, you had experience, it proved him wrong, he would just flip on it. So it wasn't doctrinaire. In fact, he talked about it later in life, saying that's a mark of a good leader is to be able to make that flip when experience and circumstances show you that you're wrong. So those are the two of the things. And then he also enjoyed all kinds of people. I mean, Hap Arnold was a guy that knew crew chiefs and ramp rats from coast to coast, starting in the early part of aviation. Remember their names. That was another thing that my pop talked about. He said his father had this absolute photographic memory for people's faces and names. He could run across some guy he hadn't seen for 30 years and say, "How's your kid so-and-so doing? You know, what happened with that? You know, are you still fishing up that particular river?" Whatever it was, he had that ability to do that, which was also key in his career.
So many great things to come to mind here that I would love to pick your brain on. We are very, very fortunate that the Stephan letter exists. This is a really fascinating letter that your grandfather, Hap Arnold, wrote
right.
to a particular individual who was serving. And it really outlines 7 points for success. And we have that roadmap that is well-published. You can read about it in oddly enough, Dick Daso's book on Hap Arnold, which is wonderful. But I want to go back even further than the Stefan letter and start back in the early 1900s at the dawn of flight when he was working literally with the Wright brothers back in Dayton. Around 1911 or so is where that story begins.
That's right. That's right. And let me give you a little bit of the prelude to that. When he's at West Point, he watches Lamb do a balloon flight, a free balloon flight from there. And he's not impressed because he says to himself, the balloon goes where the wind blows. So he doesn't see this as a military item. But then a couple of years later, he's coming back from the Far East, change of station, and he gets a day and a night in Paris. And for a kid from the main line at Philadelphia, wow, he's in Paris, the famous Paris. So he's going to see everything. And he's walking down the street, and hanging over the street is the Blériot airplane, which has just flown the English Channel, okay? And this is a massive moment. I mean, he's a West Point graduate, and he knows that, you know, Napoleon couldn't cross the English Channel, right? And here he looks up at this little trail airplane, and he says, if one can fly over this, how about many? He also reflects to himself, this isn't it, but the idea sticks in his head that it's possible. So then he goes to the Wright brothers a couple of years later. He and his pals, Tommy Milling, are the first two of the original Army contractors sent out to Dayton and to being a cadre for teaching people and doing research for the Army on these new airplanes. So, but the Wright brothers are very, very friendly, and they invite him and Tommy to sit at their table and eat dinner with them. So he's there in the Wright house. He's got Orville's, and he's got Bishop Wright, the sort of the patriarch of the family, and they got Sister Catherine. Wilbur's in France at this point. And he's a family who in a very cordial way, argue everything out. And so he's sitting there eating, and these people are arguing about what they're doing, how they're going to make stuff, where they're going. And he's watching this whole back and forth take place. And it also occurs to us later, he sees an entire aerospace industry in one small place. These people are doing engineering, design, research, training, sales. Everything that happens in the huge corporations today around a table in Dayton, Ohio. And the other thing that becomes pretty clear is Eos also knows that the greatest people in history, like Leonardo da Vinci, couldn't create flying machines. And here are this little group of, you know, middle-class Americans in Dayton, Ohio, who did it. And he says to himself, if these sorts of people can make all this happen, a whole lot of people can. In other words, the barrier, the magic, the impossibility of flight could be solved by everyday Americans. This is also a conclusion he comes to. And these folks are doing with hard work, open minds, they're always questioning the limits of things, and their persistence was absolutely key.
Providence is living. I mean, really, yeah. Truly. I mean, the fact that he was even assigned to that project.
Yeah.
And
I mean, is that?
It's just, it's miraculous, really.
Yeah, and the whole thing happens because he had wanted to be in the cavalry out of West Point. It was blocked from doing that and stuck in the infantry, and they'd sent him to the Philippines, which was a great adventure. He had a great adventure there. It was right out of a pulp novel, the backyards, the jungles, and all these characters. But he's not happy being in the infantry, and he comes back, and the Army is saying, you know, if you're silly enough to want to go fly, we could put you there.
We'd make your dreams come true real quick.
Yeah, we're probably going to kill you in the process, but we're going to do this. And so he says, okay, why not? And so this, again, is part of his character, which is like the adventurer, the open mind, all of that sort of thing is just flashing through it. And there he goes. So, you know, history puts him right there. It says, yep, you're going to meet all these people. And as we'll see later in his story, the Dayton experience has wider implications. Dayton, by the way, for most people don't know, at that point in history, has more patents per capita than any other city in the United States. And that's because all these little tinkerers and inventors are all clustered around National Cash Register Company, and then all these little spinoff companies there. So it's a real little interesting place at that time in history.
Who is Al Welsh and the relationship? Let's talk about this because it's timely at this point.
Yeah, he's key. Okay, Al Welch, at this point, when Hap Arnold runs into him, it's the key kind of lead pilot for the Wright brothers. He's the one that does demonstrations and some of the training. So he's kind of like their guy. Al Welch is the son of Ukrainian Jews who fled persecution, and they were in Ukraine, come to the United States. At point, Al is 6 years old, and so that's his experience. And he is a little go-getter. He's bright. He does lots of things in his life. He's persistent, but he becomes the Wright's chief pilot, which means at that moment in time, he's one of the most experienced pilots in the world, right? Because there are not a lot of them. Okay, he becomes Hap Arnold's friend, and in fact, he's the guy that does most of Hap Arnold's check rides at the school, and becomes a lifelong friend. Sadly, Welch dies some years later in an airplane crash, and a part of this whole series of friends that Hap Arnold loses in the early days. But he is key. So here's the thing I find so remarkable is here we're looking at a Ukrainian Jew. Now, Hap Arnold is from the main line in Pennsylvania at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. The odds that he is ever going to know anybody who is Jewish, let alone have a close relationship or a respectful peer relationship, for it's almost nil. And here it is, and he becomes his friend. And this opens the door in his mind to it matters what you do and who you are, not what you are. So this is absolutely key in playing into the whole theme of all the scientists and academic types, including Peter von Karman later, who is a Jewish refugee from Hungary.
That's where I was going to go with that, is that sort of laid that relationship foundation down. Undoubtedly, yeah. You can just imagine the joy that probably came when he met one of these people, because I'm guessing that your grandfather had the ability to identify these people probably just after a few words of talking to them.
A spark would go off
and he'd say, ah, here we go.
Yeah, and because he's there, and the other thing that happens, okay, so he comes back from the Rice to Washington, and he's flying out, he's establishing the Army's operation in College Park. He and Tommy Millen do that, and they're setting records with everything they do and all that stuff. There's a Mackey trophy involved and all kinds of things. But the other thing is that, and this is what happens today in government, all of a sudden everybody shows up wanting to sell stuff, right? Okay, so the army has nobody's experience in airplanes pretty much at all, and so they say, "Oh, you want to sell us $1 billion worth of whatever? You go talk to this Lieutenant Hap Arnold.
He could put it together for you." Yeah,
yeah, and he actually starts writing letters to his father saying these people keep showing up thinking I can give them money. Okay, but what it really means is he meets everybody. So all of these characters who part of this whole growth of the technical establishment in the United States, and we'll talk about Donald Douglas, but all of these people become his friends and associates, and he knows them personally because it's a very small world. And because there's so few people flying, and he is one of the few in the Army, which is, after all, as everybody in business knows, where the money is, right? So they come to see him and seek him out. So he becomes friendly with them, and he has an inquisitive mind. So he's asking questions. How does this stuff work? How do we do this? How do we do that? And this becomes, that's his personality coming into play.
Let's talk about Donald Douglas, because he was not only your grandfather, but a pivotal industrialist and real visionary when it comes to aerospace. And they meet and they do become friends. But, I think it goes deeper than that, in that, sure, he's a brilliant mind, obviously, a brilliant businessman. But back then, this was different. There were not a bazillion contractors in this game.
Nope.
There were just very few people. And it was all about trust and friendship at this point, because you had to believe that these people could actually get this stuff over the line. And let's not forget the timing of this, 1917. There's a lot going on in the world at this point,
right,
where air power is going to be critical. Talk about his relationship with Donald Douglas and that friendship.
Hello, everyone. Dick Daso here, AFHF Executive Director. I hope that you're enjoying Know the Past, Shape the Future, the official podcast of the AFHF. For the rest of 2024, Know the Past will focus on the technological evolution of the Air Force and Space Force during the past century. Our guests were directly involved with the programs and events that shaped the future of both air and space forces. From the 1994 New World Vistas technology study through the establishment of the Space Force in 2019, we hope you will look forward to each upcoming episode, like and subscribe. Now back to our program.
Yeah, the key to the whole thing, it starts out with Donald Douglas is the first graduate from college in aeronautical engineering, okay? So he's the new wave, right? In 1917, he is a graduate in this. So he is the new wave of guys. Okay, so 1917, the Army calls Hap Arnold to Washington as we get into the war, World War I finally, because the Signal Corps, which is running the Army Air Service at the time, all of their people are not pilots. Right? All the generals, they're not pilots. They don't know anything about this stuff. But here's this guy that does. And so they bring him to Washington and make him the youngest colonel in the U.S. Army, right? And so it's a civil war. And then you're kind of in charge of all this, although we'll just make you all these kind of weird titles and stuff they do. But he is in charge of all this. Well, at the same time, they bring this, this what they call the boy engineer, which is going to be Donald Douglas, who is this star graduate of MIT, to Washington as the chief scientist, if you will, or chief engineer of this Army Air Service. So the two of them, and again, we're talking a small operation here, get to know each other as they try to promote aircraft building and production in America and training and all this other stuff. So they become friends right there. Well, here's Donald Douglas, who again is a very personable guy and smart as heck and educated, and Hap Arnold's looking at him thinking like, this guy knows his stuff, right? I want to know more. So they become lifetime friends starting at that point. Douglas is there for about a year, and then he goes to Martin at that point, had enough of the government, and goes to work for Martin, which is right up the street in or the road in Baltimore. And he goes off into industry at that point. But the relationship is made solid at that point.
What do they do for fun? Or do you know?
What do they do for fun? Okay, well, I do know. And so both of them are sports people, right? So fishing and hunting, okay? So, for example, here's a story most people don't know. Okay, let's talk December 7, 1941.
Okay.
Where's Hap Arnold and where's Donald Douglas? They're out shooting birds in Button Willow, California is what they're doing.
And then the news travels to them there.
Yeah. So Hap has gone to Hamilton the night before. He sees the B-17s off to Pearl Harbor. Or Hickam Field, and then he goes flies the C-41A down to Button Willow, where Donald Douglas has a little hunting camp, Ma's little hunting camp. That he and his cronies would go out and shoot birds and drink Scotch whiskey and play cards and hang out. So he's going to go down there to shoot some birds and also talk, because the two of them, what's going on, where we're going, all those kind of things. Both of them know war's coming. And that's when they find out about it. So that's it. So that's the kind of stuff they did. They like to go shooting and hunting, and basically that sort of thing. They're sports guys.
At the right place at the right time is something that just runs all through your grandfather's lives, both of them.
Right.
The Kettering bug, which I think is one of the most fascinating pieces of history, and also one of the most underappreciated artifacts, perhaps, at the Udvar Hazy Center there in D.C. But when you go there, there's this little thing, and it looks like a twine dispenser if you don't have much of an imagination to think of it as what it really is, the part, if you will, the heartbeat of the system in this Kettering bug, that piece made by Sperry. Talk about the significance of the Kettering bug, the early drone there with Hap Arnold.
Oh. Yeah, 1917 to 1918, the U.S. Army actually builds the first cruise missile. Okay, that's an amazing statement, right?
Yeah.
And where's it come? It comes out of Dayton, Ohio. Okay. So this little group of genius inventors and little manufacturers there sat around Orville Wright, who is still with us and has that relationship with Hap Arnold, of course. And then there's this other fellow named Charles Kettering. Kettering is another one of these little American geniuses. So he ends up on the cover of Time magazine. He's the guy that invents the electric starter for automobiles with his Dayton Electric Company. We now know it's Delco, which some of us may remember. Oh, sure. You know, he's in involved with the production of small compressors for air conditioning using Freon, all kinds of stuff. He's one of those little guys. He's an American inventor genius. Okay, but Hap Arnold has also gotten to know through Orville Wright. So Kettering comes up with this idea of making his little Grings vessels and talking to Orville, and I mean, they're all there. And there's other people involved. So their friend, Elmer Sperry, who is busy making kind of little control systems, comes in with gyroscopic controls and stuff like that. So pretty soon you got this little team there who comes up with this idea of this tiny little cheap biplane that you could put a bomb in and you could launch it across the trenches of World War I. Now, remember what the big problem is. It's that for 3 years, you've had this trench warfare in stalemate in France, which is killing millions of people, and they can't break through. So the idea is, how can we launch something over here and start blowing up stuff on the other side, right? Okay.
And so, literally from a trench. I mean, if you hit
it. Yeah, you go right over them and blow up stuff. Okay. So this is, and they're cheap, and you can build a lot of them. That's the thought. Okay. So the Army throws some money at it. It doesn't go real well, so they stick Cap Arnold in charge of it, which the Army had a tendency to do at that point. Okay. Also involved is Henry Ford. Okay. He's another player. And Henry Ford is supposed to make these kind of motorcycle engines to go in this thing. And the quality control is absolutely terrible. So this is also part of the lesson about how automobile manufacturers magically making airplanes doesn't work out so well. Okay. This is not a lesson lost on Hap Arnold later. So they finally, they come up with a couple of prototypes. They have spectacular failures. One of which Hap Arnold wrote about and liked to tell the story is they go out there, they got all these brass hats, as he called them, sitting in like bleachers, and they got to launch this thing. It's going to go for about a mile and it's going to go blow up something. Okay. So the damn thing takes off and the control system fails and it dives right at the bleachers full of all the Army brass. Okay. We all dive over the back of the bleachers and start running. The plane pulls up and does about three dives on them and then disappears.
And anyone who's ever been to a model airplane field can, you know, completely relate to this experience.
And he loved telling this story because he would go, and they all got in cars and went chasing a stamp. And now this is super secret, right? This is like the Manhattan Project of World War One. Okay, so they go chasing this thing, and it finally crashes in the Sun Farmer's field. And, you know, and Farmer Fred comes walking out, you know, looking at this thing. And so Hap Arnold says, well, it's the pilot bailed out a while back, so he's okay. You know, it's not really what you think you see.
Wow.
So they carry this stuff out and take care of that. But they have this sort of colored history of the test line on this thing, because we're talking cutting-edge technology. Yeah, the key point with this darn thing is Hap Arnold now learns to meet some more people, right? He's worked with them. They know him. And then, of course, in his career, the key moment is he's trying to get into the war. He's a professional soldier, and he wants to go fly airplanes and shoot Germans, right? I mean, that's what he's supposed to do. And the Army won't let him go, right? Because he's the key guy. And he's looking at this thing saying, if I don't get in this war over there, my career is going to be crap after the war. So what he does, he finally convinces them to send him to Europe with talk to tell Pershing about the bug. That's how he's going to get there. And once he gets there, he's going to talk into his old buddies to give him an airplane so he can go fly and shoot something, right? That's the plan.
But it works out. I mean, it does work out.
He gets the flu, the famous Spanish flu on the way over, almost dies, and doesn't get to fly over the trenches until the morning of November 11th, right? So he never gets the opportunity to shoot anything. The key moment in that, though, is that he writes about in his diary, is that he observes allies at war, specifically the French and the British, and not liking what he sees. He doesn't like the way they're treating our people. He doesn't like the way they're treating the supplies that we've sent. This is a guy who stumbled along in the peacetime army with no money of anything. And these are people who are taking all the stuff that we've sent them and treating it badly and everything else like that. He writes about this so that the little caveats about allies in war is not lost on him years later.
I want to fast forward in the few minutes we have left here, because there's so much to cover with Hap Arnold, with both of your grandfathers, Hap Arnold and Donald Douglas. But let's fast forward with the lessons learned, because this is so critical. We were talking about Al Welsh earlier and his relationship. In walks Von Karman. We've been talking about Theodore Von Karman and and the significance that he and your grandfather had on what we're doing today, even.
Yeah, the entree is interesting because the entree of Karman to Arnold works on a couple of levels. It's all about Caltech and the Douglas Aircraft Company. Okay, so his friend Donald Douglas and Donald Douglas' key guys, which is Bailey Oswald and Arthur Raymond, are all Arthur Raymond and Oswald are key Karman guys at Caltech and the wind tunnel over there. So there's this introductory from them and also from Milliken. Dr. Milliken is the head of Caltech at that point, who Hap Arnold has learned has met on doing some experiments with him. In aviation, that all of them mention this guy Karman. Okay, now if you get the head of Caltech and a Nobel Prize winner, you get Donald Douglas, you get Arthur Raymond and Bailey Oswald saying this guy Theodore von Karman is a good dude. That's all Hap Arnold has to know. I mean, this is a good guy. Okay, so bingo, this is a guy that is worthy of respect and trust. And so when the two of them get together, Karman apparently sees the same thing. He sees this guy as a guy with an open mind, asking questions, straight shooter, somebody he can trust. He's not one of these sort of government types who are usually, looking after the rice bowl and all that kind of stuff. He's actually a guy who's got a vision. He sees over the top of the trees. He's looking forward. He's talking about science with some intelligence, all that kind of stuff. So all of that set up, bingo. I mean, it's just like a magic thing it takes place.
What do you want people to know about Hap Arnold that most of us don't know, that carries all of this forward? I mean, such a brilliant mind, but what really sticks out to you?
Well, it's a couple of things, one of which is that he's several things. He's a man who is not a self-promoter in the way that some people would be. His client is always Air Power and the future of that. World War II, he says to his spots, I want you to be the Pershing of this war. In other words, he doesn't see himself as the hero, that he uses people paying attention to him to further the enterprise, He's also somebody who is not satisfied with today, whatever it is. And the technology limits of today are not important because he's already seen beyond them. He says, okay, jet planes or the rocket planes are coming. Yeah, we don't have them right now. That doesn't mean we won't have them tomorrow. He's got that faith in tomorrow based on his relationship with all his technical character. A guy who absolutely will fight for what he believes in, a guy who has life experiences, leads him up to all of these lessons. And by 1941, so he is ready to operate as somebody who can create the world's largest and most powerful air force from nothing. Can operate on every continent but Antarctica after a couple of years, who can at any particular time have tens of thousands of aircraft in the air and all of these sort of things. All his life experience and his character leads to that moment, which makes all that possible. And then that's not even enough. He's already thinking beyond that by 1945, which is why Karman comes into it, and all these other things. He's already thinking that, okay, that was yesterday. The one thing I don't want to do is what happened after World War One, where the U.S. government, the U.S. Army decided they could be flying biplanes for the rest of their life, forever. We have to think about tomorrow because the Germans created all this technology while we were not doing it, and we won't have the time the next time. In other words, we can't say it'll be the same thing, that we have all the time in the world to create this production thing, and even though they outclass us in technology, we will not have time in an atomic age.
And the rest is history. That all began literally around the dinner table at the Wright's house, which...
Absolutely.
Just phenomenal. Fascinating stuff. And I love the idea of it's not what you are, it's who you are, that we see carrying over time and time again, his willingness to just be so accepting of these absolutely brilliant people that he meets along the way. Robert Arnold, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Enjoyed talking to you, Matt.
Our sincere thanks to Robert Arnold for sharing his personal stories and in many cases, the backstories on how this history came together. We'll continue our conversation on the technological origins of the modern United States Air Force on our next episode. So be sure and like, follow, and subscribe so you don't miss out. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'm Matt Jolly. Know the past, shape the future. Thank you.